the Chow Hall and see. Welcome. My name is Dustin Ingles. I'm the General Manager for Security and Identity Operations for Microsoft IT. I've been there for 22 years, and it's been a pretty interesting journey. I ran all of Microsoft's data centers and networks worldwide from 2000 to 2003, which was when we had Code Red, Nimda, Slammer, do a little web searching, maybe around September of 99, you might see there was some other interesting activity that happened and was covered in the news. Made our big transition to smart cards, did all kinds of interesting stuff, which was really kind of my big intro into the security world. And then I moved into our product engineering teams for 12 years. I ran the System Center Configuration Manager team, and then I moved to another country called Boston and ran the integration of a company called Softricity, which became AppV. And then I came back to Redmond to run the program management team for the Windows security team. So I got to work with building the security features in Windows 7, 8, 8.1, the return of the start button release, 8.1 update 1, and Windows 10. And after shipping Windows 10, decided it was time to go back to school. The IT cyber environment has changed so much since I had been in IT 12 years earlier. I really wanted to go back and learn a lot. So I've been back there for a year, and it's been an incredible year. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on. So what I'd like to share in this session is just some of the interesting things that keep us awake at night and some of the approaches we were able to use our Windows 10 rollout to kind of really change the way we think about security, both from a device perspective as well as really leveraging the cloud perspective. So just to kind of orient everyone around, we have I work in the Information Security and Risk Management organization. And we have this purpose statement that's about enabling Microsoft to build the most trusted devices and services while keeping our company safe and our data protected. And the big emphasis there is on the word enable, right? Because we all know what happens when security gets in the way. When we first rolled out, when we switched from using username and password to switching to physical smart cards for remote access, we did that in 2001. Before we rolled out physical smart cards, roughly 85% of our employees used remote access to stay productive while they're on the road or working from home or whatever the case may be. After rolling out physical smart cards, the usage dropped to 35% because of all that friction and setting it up and remembering your smart card and having the dongle and all that stuff. But at the same time, we saw a real surge in the use of an email forwarding solution built by a company called Research in Motion. So in our attempt to improve security without really focusing on enabling end users and making life easier, we kind of fostered one of the first big data exfiltration events in our history. So a lot of really, really, really focus on enablement as opposed to, you know, that classic notion of just protect regardless of the experience. We have four security principles that we just share across the company. This isn't just the security team talking, but this is, you know, this is the CEO talking, which is our first priority is to protect customer data. As you can imagine, you know, being a cloud services company, that's the most important thing. Microsoft runs on trust, and if we can't protect customers' data, no one's going to trust us. So that is the company's first priority. The second for us is ensuring device integrity. It's really hard to protect customer data if you don't have secure devices. Third is protecting our supply chain. I think most folks know why that's becoming more important as we see a lot of interesting security events that have come up recently. That's super important. And then finally, number four is protecting Microsoft's intellectual property. Now that probably seems obvious to folks that are customers of Microsoft, but if you ran around our campus in Redmond and just asked people, hey, what do you think is the most important thing to protect? Well, if you talk to a software engineer, they're going to say, our source code, right? So this was a very important way to kind of reorient the Microsoft engineers of old and really change the focus from, hey, protecting our source code is not important if we don't have any customers. So that's kind of just a view of where we're at from a priority standpoint. From an environment standpoint, what kind of environment do we have to work in? We have about 114,000 employees, another 103, that this number varies, but vendors, temporary staff, business guests, interns, 775 locations worldwide. So big geographic footprint, lots to protect. Roughly 1.2 million devices accessing our network. So that's about 600,000 devices that actually connect to our wired network, another 600,000 that are connecting in all kinds of different interesting ways. And of those, 600,000 devices that I talked about that connect to our wired network, only 200,000 of those are under management. So it's, with test labs and software development going on, it's an interesting environment to work in. We collect about 15 to 20 billion security events per day. That's a lot of security events, which means to some, that's, like my boss, Brett Arsenault, he's the CISO, he's like, let's go, I want more events. But if you can't see what's in there, if you can't separate the signal from the noise, having 15, 20 billion events per day doesn't really help. In terms of, how we think about focus, this is an important thing that we've really had to ingrain in our security culture. Everybody likes to talk about advanced persistent threats. But really, if you look at what's happened, if you look at breach after breach, event after event, 90%, fully 90% of events happen because of basic hygiene. Basic things like, updates management, vulnerability management, et cetera. But people want to focus on the tail there. People want to focus on the exciting, the exotic, the stuff they haven't seen before. And for us, that's been one of the great things about moving to the cloud. We're in roughly 50% transition, but we have a goal over the next 18 months of getting almost 90% of our on-prem assets into the cloud. And the great thing about moving this stuff to the cloud is we don't have to think about a lot of that basic hygiene stuff anymore. I don't have to patch online SharePoint servers. I don't have to maintain all this on-prem infrastructure. The cloud does it for me, so I can redirect resources and focus more on those tail-style attacks, some of the advanced persistent threats, and other more interesting stuff that's coming along. So what keeps us up at night? Kind of a funny little slide I borrowed from my boss here, but if you look at, look at the C-suite and what people are doing, usually the CEO is pretty comfortable in bed, just sitting there enjoying the day, thinking about what's transpired. CFO, a little less comfortable. Maybe you have an analyst thing coming up. COO is tossing and turning a bit, throwing the covers around, lots to focus on. But the CISO hasn't even gone to bed yet. Always up, there's always a security event, there's always something to do. Suffice it to say, you'll never get bored. So, but let's talk about, when we think about security, we like to use, how many people are familiar with the kill chain concept? So Lockheed Martin took a military concept and applied it to cybersecurity. This is, I'll say, kind of an abridged version of how we think about the kill chain, but we really focus on disrupting each link along the line. So when I talk about where we focus and how we think about these challenges, it's really about disrupting each specific step in the kill chain. So right now I want to focus on, four specific elements. Delivery, how do they get into the environment? The actual exploitation, getting malware running inside your environment. And then, we have command and control, setting up, talking back to command and control servers, and really, okay, I've got the payload in, now what am I gonna do? And then finally, actions on the objective. Why do people come in? They come in to steal data, they come in to steal IP, they come in to steal identities. And so, listed a number of different incidents here. The names are not there to protect the innocent, but I'm sure a lot of these are fairly familiar. These are all grabs straight from news headlines. So what approach did we take? Phishing. Phishing is the one that, this is how they always get in, right? This is protecting the front door. Everyone's familiar with the password problem, and we've been on a mission to really switch to multi-factor auth for everything. Most companies, are still kind of in a perimeter-based mode where you require multi-factor auth at the edge, multi-factor auth for VPN, multi-factor auth for going to the cloud, but typically, a lot of folks still use single-factor auth internally. We're in the process of moving to multi-factor auth, but in trying not to repeat that lesson that we learned with smart cards, we're really focusing on how do we do that in a way that's really easy to use, and that's why we've focused a lot on our Hello for Business rollout. Malware and hacking. How many of you have gone to the Executive Briefing Center on Microsoft's campus in Redmond? If you ever get a chance to go again, definitely visit the our CDOC, our Cyber Defense Operations Center. So that's where we take all of the security monitoring folks that work in my organization, as well as Azure Office 365 and the Windows and Devices Group, all in one place. So we can collaborate, share information easily, and without a doubt, we use ArcSight as our SIEM, we use a number of the same tools that everyone uses, but one of the crowd pleasers in the room is Windows Defender Advanced Threat Protection. I'm gonna show you a little bit more about that later, but it is everyone's favorite tool. They love to talk about it, they love to use it, and I'll show you some of the reasons why. Lateral movement. How many folks are familiar with Pass the Hash? Pretty much everybody, even the folks who haven't raised their hand. This is the tough one, right? We talked about how phishing is always the way in. This is really where that assume breach mentality comes home to roost, because no matter what you do, someone in your organization is going to click on that link. It's going to happen. And when that does, what's the very first thing they do, right? Everybody tries to pivot around the organization and move laterally. And the most common way that happens is pass the hash. So Windows 10, I would say, is the first time we really had, there's been lots of pass the hash mitigations, but Windows 10 was the first time we really had a solution that we could deploy broadly in the environment. And then finally, we got to protect our admins. Because again, assume that someone's going to click on the link, and assume that we have to develop an environment where people are free to do, we're building software, we're building services. People have to have the productivity and the flexibility to do a lot of stuff. But admins, people that are able to reach into the fabric, people that have access to customer data, they have to get the absolute highest level of protection. So as a reward for coming to this session, I'm going to show you some stuff that no one's ever seen before. Show you a little bit about the secret sauce of what we do inside Microsoft to protect admins. And this is all stuff that we've built on top of Windows 10 and really been able to leverage some of the security features that came in Windows 10 and Windows Server 2016. So first, let's talk about credential theft. What's funny about preparing for Ignite is, they ask you to have your draft decks in really early, and then they give you a certain amount of time to change your decks. And I have a number of different news articles and industry events that I put on this, and I've had to change this slide like three times because it just keeps happening. And the Yahoo one was obviously, it was big news. It's the biggest credential theft event that's ever happened. But there's only one thing I know about this event, that it's the last event until the next event. This stuff is going to keep happening. So clearly, especially from an IT perspective, we have to find a way to get people off of passwords, because there's just no reasonable way to protect them. It's not that these companies are doing anything wrong. It's just when you have determined attackers, they're going to find a way to get to this stuff. And just the amazingly creative ways, they don't go after Fort Knox. They go after the little guy somewhere off in the corner. And then because passwords are so difficult to use, the vast majority of people just use their same password everywhere. And so they just pivot around, and eventually they get control of something interesting, and then they've got you. So clearly we have to get off passwords. Now, since it's just us and we're talking about Microsoft IT, and internally I want to talk a little bit about a little event we had in 2014. So in 2014, as luck would have it, this always happens during the holidays, we received a visit from the Syrian Electronic Army. And we got a little bit of intel, we got some insight that they were going to come visit. But needless to say, we weren't completely ready. And they did some impressive things. So, I told you about how we've been moving towards multi-factor auth everywhere, and have we have a lot of our resources in the cloud. So we make extensive use of Azure Active Directory Federation services. So Microsoft employees are very used to this experience where if they go try and access a resource in the cloud, they land on this ADFS landing page that has a picture that they're used to, and it's all these things. And the Syrian Electronic Army basically set up a phishing site that actually had redirects to our real site for all the visual assets that would be displayed on the page. So So they were able to render a view that looked exactly like the view that Microsoft employees see. And, well, as I said, everybody clicks on the link, and there were some folks that definitely clicked on that link and entered some credentials. And what these folks were up to, that, you know, their actual objective, when we talk about the kill chain and actions on objective, what they really wanted to do is gain intelligence about to what degree Microsoft was sharing information with governments and law enforcement and how that stuff works. But they didn't want us to know what they were up to, so they kind of masqueraded as a social networking attack. They went after all of our social networking accounts. And, you know, it's not exactly fun when the Microsoft official Twitter account is tweeting, hey, whatever you do, don't use Microsoft email. So it was an interesting holiday for folks. And, the other part that was super interesting is how they switched tactics. When we kind of really figured out all the right IOCs for how they were phishing us, they apparently had anticipated that in advance, because then they switched to a malware-based attack. So it was a very educational experience for us. Now, there was a good side to this, which is because this stuff was in the cloud, and we were able to develop, and identify the indicators of compromise from this, we were able to look across Office 365 and say, oh, wow, look, there's these other customers that are seeing the same thing. So, we were able to let other customers know much earlier in their process that this was going on. But, this is, if you think about the kill chain that we talked about, this is all those classic techniques. They come in, they do reconnaissance, they get in, then they set up command and control, and with their objective of taking over those social networking accounts as a way of embarrassing Microsoft and kind of taking the spotlight away from what they were really trying to do. So I talked about Windows Hello for Business. How many people have had a chance to experience Hello? So Hello is really the evolution of strong auth support in Windows. Started off with physical smart card support, and then in Windows 8 it evolved into the concept of virtual smart cards. And with Hello for Business, the objective was really to say, hey, can we create a single form of strong authentication that works across the consumer world and it works across the enterprise? That it has all the security attributes that you'd expect out of a smart card, but with the ease of use of something as simple as a 4 or 6-digit PIN, face recognition, or use of your fingerprint. I borrowed this from their diagram, so it kind of has the Hello-like appearance, but just the basics of how it works is, the user authenticates to their device using either a PIN that can be set by IT policy or face recognition or fingerprint recognition. And what that does is that unlocks the key container. And what this key container does is it stores keys that the user enrolls in for different services. So the whole point of that is making sure that users don't have to have different PINs or different enrollments for all the different keys that they collect over time. Because the vision here is this becomes the way you authenticate to everything, right? Not just within the enterprise, but this is also how you authenticate to Google Docs. This is also how you authenticate to Facebook. That's the vision down the road. So it's really designed as one master key unlocks a secure, hardware-protected container of keys, which is what securely authenticates you to the resource. So why is this great? Well, this means that there's no shared secret. There's nothing that an attacker can steal that allows them to masquerade as you when they go to other devices. So it's a pretty critical step forward from us. On the back end, if you're a small or medium-sized business that has just said, I'm going straight to the cloud, it's fairly simple in the back end. It's all there for you. So you just join into Azure Active Directory. It communicates with the device registration service, and you're cooking at that point. In a hybrid mode, it's a little bit more complicated. Now, it's designed to do both Active Directory Kerberos-based authentication as well as Azure Active Directory authentication. So it works back and forth across environments. But in a hybrid world, you really have to be planning about how you deploy. You're going to be in a mode where you deploy some of these clients that are classic domain join clients. But you get single sign-on on your classic on-prem assets that also extends through ADFS to the cloud. But then over time, you'll migrate to Azure Active Directory join devices that will natively get single sign-on into the cloud, but also this is smart enough to, whenever it has line of sight to the domain controller, it'll go grab a Kerberos TGT, pull it back in, and give you a full single sign-on to on-premise resources. So an interesting thing for us, this is, you know, looking at number of authentications per day. We've been, you know, kind of trucking along with Microsoft employees really like virtual smart cards because it got them away from physical smart cards. We pretty much, I'll talk a little bit later about physical smart cards and why they're still in use. It's primarily for admins. But a very interesting thing happened in July when we rolled out the anniversary update or Redstone release of Windows 10, which introduced some, you know, fairly important provisioning bug fixes, made it super, super smooth. Microsoft is an environment where we give employees choice. You have to use multi-factor auth, but we'll let you do it the way you want to do it. You can use a physical smart card, you can use a virtual smart card, you can use Hello, and you can also do phone-based authentication where you have the, you can either get a, you know, a call, you can get an SMS, or you can use the Azure Authenticator app. When we started rolling this Windows 10 Anniversary Edition in July, it skyrocketed. And this wasn't because, you know, we told people about it. This was just people voting with their feet and saying, this is an awesome experience. An interesting stat I don't have here. Our authentication ecosystem is still not perfect. So, you know, you still see prompts here and there. You know, this is something that engineers are definitely working on. But one of the things we observed is someone using, signing in with Hello for Business, in our world where we turn on MFA everywhere, sees only 20% of the authentication prompts that someone would see if they signed in another way. So it's you know, it's a great benefit for us from a security perspective, but it's also it's a great experience for users. Many less authentication prompts and gotten a lot of positive comments. So our experience, lessons learned, things to think about. It got a lot easier with the Windows 10 Anniversary Edition. A lot of critical bugs fixed, and as I told you, I worked in the Windows team when we were shipping Windows 10, so needless to say, I get a lot of feedback from my boss about, hey, why doesn't this work? Why doesn't this work? They really nailed it with the Anniversary Edition. It is a really smooth experience from the back end and how IT thinks about provisioning to how users enroll themselves. If you can do Azure Active Directory domain join, that's just smooth. It's easy. There's just nothing to do. You basically set a policy, and you're off to the races. But for enterprises, you're probably going to be in hybrid mode for the foreseeable future. So you really need to think about how you deploy this with ADFS, how you do on-premises enrollment with System Center Configuration Manager, and you know how you potentially do Azure Active Directory management with Intune. But the final and most important thing, and we have learned this over and over and over again, there is no substitute for user education and awareness when you're making changes like this. One of the interesting things that we found, we've done such a good job of convincing users that passwords have to be, you know, 32 characters of Klingon and all kinds of crazy stuff that, you know, it's finally ingrained in users' heads. So now when you come along and you say, hey, just use a 6-digit numeric PIN, people are like, oh, whoa, I can't do that. That's smaller than correct horse battery staple. I can't do that. And so when we very first turned this feature on, only 50% of our employees actually used it. Even though they got prompted, said, please set up a PIN, please use it, users were so used to the thrashing that they got about password complexity that they felt that just a PIN was less secure. So then we had to engage in an awareness campaign that said, hey, here's why PINs are more secure than a password when they're used this way. It's not a symmetric secret. Even if somebody gets your PIN, they have to steal your device, and that's fundamentally different than stealing a password. So just important pro tip, when you roll out this feature, education awareness, helping users understand why face recognition is okay, why fingerprint recognition is okay, why a 6-digit PIN is okay, is critical to getting users to understand why they should start doing that instead of their password in an environment where you still allow them to use both. So let's move on to pass the hash. So this is you know, one of those things. It's been interesting working in security over time, watching pass the hash go from something that was purely conceptual, because it, you know, it used to be a fairly complicated attack. I mean, you had to write very specialized code, you had to inject it into the local security authority, cause it to dump its hashes, and then you had to figure out how to use that to move across the network. Used to be hard. But then they came out with this tool called Mimikatz, which just completely automates the process of dumping the stuff out of LSA, and then they integrated it into Metasploit and other popular attacker toolkits, which made it super easy. So almost overnight, it went from this thing that, you know, security guys like to geek out with on the whiteboard to something that, you know, at any security conference, people are nervously looking at each other every time the concept of pass the hash comes up. So how does Windows 10 help us out there? So how many people have heard about Credential Guard? So one of the biggest, most fundamental security changes in Windows 10, other than Hello for Business, is the introduction of virtualization-based security. So now you can really put the hardware in the device to work for you. So, and I'll talk a little bit more about this in a second. I'll skip over this overview of past the hashtags, because everybody knows how they work. You click on something, the attacker gets to run code on your machine, they inject into LSA, dump hashes, and then they do a couple of interesting things. They either, you know, pivot from machine to machine until they find an elevated account, or a lot of times they'll just do something on your device that will cause a user to call help desk. And when the user calls help desk says, hey, let me remote into your machine, see what's going on, and they contact that machine with a highly privileged account, and now the attacker can move freely about the cabin, so to speak. So it's something that attackers are just have, there's just so much automation around this these days that once they get in, they can move around very, very quickly. So what happens with Credential Guard? So if you have a suitable device that has at least TPM 1.2 or TPM 2.0 and supports hardware virtualization extensions, what happens is we have an always-on hypervisor mode where you have this very tiny but very secure version of Windows that only runs tiny little apps we call trustlets. And one of the trustlets that it runs is in basically a storage plugin for the local security authority. So remember that thing that Mimikatz does, it tries to inject code into LSA and steal stuff? Well, it can't, because that part of the local security authority gets moved over into this tiny little trustlet running in a completely different version of the OS. So it's completely different OS, it runs at a higher privilege level than the main OS, and even in a world where there's bugs in that OS, even in a world where there's bugs in the hypervisor, it still uses hardware level features like IOMMU to make sure that the hardware actually says, hey, Mr. Main OS, you cannot peer into the memory space of this other OS. So it allows us to take those critical credential secrets that attackers always go after to pivot around the environment and move them into a safe place where they're secure at rest. And so the great thing about that is it breaks Mimikatz, which hasn't made us very popular with red teams. So how many people have red teams in their environment? So, you know, red teams are, they're there to constantly test your defenses, where you hire your own people to hack your own environment and really understand more about your environment, where the vulnerabilities are. They don't like this feature, because every red team report I would always read always starts out the same way. Got user to click link, ran Mimikatz, got some credentials, and then the interesting stuff happens. I mean, they use this thing so often it became routine, and now they can't use that anymore. So does that mean we're totally safe from credential theft? No. Does it mean we've been able to really raise the bar in terms of how we protect credentials at rest in our environment, especially as we're transitioning to technologies like Hello for Business and transitioning away from legacy applications that still rely on NTLM? Yes, it's a super helpful thing. Stuff you need to know, though, you just need to be thoughtful. This is one of those features, you know, if you're going from just a regular run-on-iron PC to a hypervisor always on, well, there may be some, there may be compat impacts, so it is something you do want to test, and it is something as you think about hardware procurement lists or what kind of hardware you're procuring, you just need to make sure that it has a TPM. Please make sure it has a TPM. It needs to be 64-bit, boot native, secure boot, and needs to support hardware virtualization extensions. Sorry? Do we deploy this in China? Yes, we do. So the question is, can you get a TPM in China? I'm just going to refer you to your legal team on that. You know, I will just simply say, you know, we have devices in China that use TPM. It's not necessarily a straightforward process, but what I will say is That's one of the great things about TPM 2.0. TPM 2.0 was designed with a lot of these learnings in place, and there is now a native Chinese manufacturer of TPM 2.0 devices. So the environment has gotten a lot better. And frankly, you know, I say have at least TPM 1.2, but you definitely want to have TPM 2.0 anyway. So let's talk a little bit about malware. So it's been an interesting world since the Mandiant report, right? When the Mandiant report happened, there was this watershed moment where that report came out and the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times got hacked. That was awesome from a security profession standpoint, because before that happened, everybody was getting hacked and nobody would talk about it. It was Fight Club, right? Nobody wanted to share. You couldn't share because your competition would use that against you. But when this report happened, and just kind of the awareness of the scale of what was going on, coupled with the fact, if you go hack a news organization, well, they think about that very, very differently, because that's a story, and they want to talk about it. And, you know, that was really the time that people realized there's two types of enterprises in the U.S. and, you know, frankly, abroad: those that know they've been hacked and those that haven't yet figured out that they've been hacked. And so now we're in this world where now people are coming out of the woodwork, and you start to understand the incredible underground ecosystem around zero days. And now it's getting brazen, right? As these things become more and more financially valuable, you know, even the purveyors of zero days used to be confined to the dark web, but now it's something that people will talk about openly. So it's a huge, huge business. And it's just, you can't rely on bug-free software. So, you know, we have to be in a posture where we're able to find malware, detect it quickly, and stop it from spreading. So, and I'm going to talk about this on kind of two different axes. The first being just how do we protect the general user population? How do we protect the folks that click links? How do we protect folks that get those interesting emails? And there's a number, this is, of course, with anything in security, has to be a layered defense. Starts with, you know, hardware-based secure boot and Windows Trusted Boot, and, you know, using Windows Defender, using technologies like Device Guard, user mode code integrity, App Locker. You know, make sure you're controlling the apps that run. But this, you know, Windows Defender Advanced Threat Protection, this is the coolest security tool to come on in a long time. And like I said, if you come to Redmond, come to the CDOC, and you'll get to see analysts give a very enthusiastic perspective of what goes on. So how does it work? So the Defender agent is included in all Windows 10 devices, and there's this special sends agent that is able to send information to Windows Defender Advanced Threat Protection, even if you're using other anti-malware solutions. It's really up to you. And it's really behavior and algorithmic based. Right? It's not that classic static signature-based detection. But what's interesting is it does a very good job of correlating and getting everything into a single place, so it's easy for analysts to visualize, but it also adds the feature of detonation. So you're able to take, if you see stuff that looks suspicious in your environment, an analyst can just push a button, it'll send that file up into the cloud gets detonated, and you get a full report. But then, you know, behind that, you have basically the power of Microsoft's clouds. All of Microsoft's customers, all these customers send up telemetry. So we get signals from all these different places, right? Instead of just seeing the attacks that you see, you see the attacks that all Azure customers see. And then, you know, we have within our the Microsoft Malware Protection Center, you know, we have hunters that are specifically looking for the classic advanced persistent threat. But we also have a lot of different industry collaborations. So there's an enormous amount of threat intelligence that kind of flows in to Windows Advanced Threat Protection on the back end. All of that gets surfaced in a single console that analysts can use, or they can also, or in addition, use a SIEM connector to connect it to their SIEM of choice, right? So if you want to take this stuff into ArcSight, take it into Splunk, take it into QRadar, you can do that as well. But let's take a little bit of a look at how it works. So you can see in the main dashboard, you know, right now there's 87 alerts in progress. And if I click on that, you'll see, you know, there's two alerts for this machine, a Skype machine. First, you know, that it sees a suspicious process connecting to LSA, and then, you know, it says, hey, wait a sec, this is Mimikatz. And what's interesting about that, when we go look at that, basically, if we click on this machine, and we can kind of look at the timeline of what happened. So, you know, they clicked on something, and then command shell was opened, and it ran this process called test.exe. So now, again, because it's behavior-based, Defender ATP watches this test.exe connect to LSA, watches that pattern of behavior, and says, aha, I know what this is. This is Mimikatz. So then I can actually click on that, and now I can see, hey, what's going on across the environment? What other machines are seeing this? So I can pivot immediately from, hey, I saw this on one device, to where else is this happening in my environment? And then finally, another thing, you know, I talked about detonation. This is the crowd pleaser. This is one of my favorite features is, you know, we don't always know what files are doing, right? We know, based on signatures and based on behaviors, you saw in that one case, hey, I know that's Mimikatz. But we don't always get that benefit. Sometimes we just think something is suspicious. Well, typically what analysts would have to do, they'd have to spend a bunch of time researching and trying to figure out what is this file doing exactly. I mean, some companies don't even have the resources to just go take this file apart and figure out, hey, is this some software developer that it was off doing something, or is this just, you know, what we call potentially unwanted software that's just, you know, it's not malicious, but it's not doing anything useful. Or is this something really bad? And so on this particular machine, the highlighted machine that a file suspected as a backdoor is observed. So I can click on that, and right away I can get a lot of information about, you know, this is super helpful, especially for organizations that don't necessarily have their own SOC or, they don't have dedicated security professionals for this. Defender Advanced Threat Protection provides a lot of information about what are you seeing and what kinds of things can you do about it. But the super interesting thing is, you know, I can click on a file and I can see not just the prevalence within my organization, but the prevalence across all the different machines that Defender Advanced Threat Protection sees. So you get a view that says, hey, across everybody who's a customer of this service, how often do we see this particular file? And it will give you, you know, that's just more information that you can use to determine, is this a threat? But finally, and more interestingly, you see that button where it says deep analysis. I can just push the submit button, and it'll go up into the cloud. The file will be detonated inside its own virtual machine, and then it comes back with a very detailed report of exactly what the file did. So again, if this is not something, it just looks suspicious, but you can't tell exactly what it is, you can very, very quickly figure out what exactly is this file up to and what has it done. So it's become a very, very critical resource for our analysts in the Security Operations Center to figure out what's going on. Sorry, you have a question? So the question is the detonation time-based? That's a great question. So any technology like this is always an arms race, right? In the blue team, red team metaphor, the blue team is always developing new ways of detecting, new ways of thinking about it. The red team sees the new things that the blue team have done, and they try and develop evasions. And certainly, lying in wait, so to speak, not doing anything malicious for a period of time is one of the interesting things that is, you know, attackers know that there's more and more file detonation going on. We see this from different vendors as well. And sure, they definitely try and develop ways of working around that, but then, you know, you still have that chess game going on with you. You keep using new technologies to do that, and there's a lot of different activities you can inject into that detonation chamber to try and trick it and make it think that it's but it's not perfect. It's one more layer of defense in depth. So our experience with this, the fact that it's just in Windows is awesome, because it's not a tool that we have to deploy. It's merely a service that we just turn on. It's always active, which means, in a world where, our users are mobile, we see just as much work traffic going on from Starbucks to the cloud as we see from Microsoft's network to the cloud. So, you know, having this kind of real-time reporting and the ability to pivot on threats, no matter where a user is, no matter what they're doing, is super important. Being able to have just one enterprise view of what's going on, immediately pivoting from that. You know, everybody's seen the anti-malware alert where, hey, so-and-so machine detected, blah. But, you know, the minute you figure out that blah is a bad thing, the first question you got to ask is, wow, how much more of that is, you know, as I go to protecting myself against whatever this executable is, how much more of that is going on across the enterprise? So being able to very rapidly get a view of where else is this going on, is super good to have. Now the warning. Oh, sorry, you have a question? So the question is, how do these devices get associated? We do it a number of ways, but it is primarily through management and turning on a policy. So when they become part of a namespace. And the question is, what management tools? Yes, you can do it through group policy. You can do it through MDM. There's a number of different ways to turn it on. So, but the thing that I want to warn you about is the awesome thing about this tool is you can see a lot of stuff. The bad thing about this tool is you can see a lot of stuff. So when you turn this thing on, you better be prepared because you're going to find a lot of stuff in your environment. There will be a shock and awe moment where you just look at the sheer number of things that it found the moment you turned it on. So you need to be honest and ready to send an army of people off to fix the issues that you're going to find. And then the last thing, and this is true, you know, anytime we build a console, you know, it's really hard to build a console that works really, really well with an organization of 20 PCs and really, really well with an organization of 600,000 PCs. So, you know, for larger organizations, definitely want to be thinking about using the SIEM connector so you can send the high-profile alerts into the SIEM. So that becomes your primary alert point, and you see the high alert in the SIEM. And then analysts can come back into the Seville console the Windows Defender Advanced Threat Protection console, sorry, Chris, and pivot directly to that information about, wow, what exactly is this? What's the prevalence in my organization? What's the prevalence worldwide? And then, what do I need to do about this? Okay. So now let's talk about some of our fun internal secret sauce stuff, protecting our admins. So we have a service we call Secure Admin Services, and it's comprised of a number of separate services. It's not just one monolithic thing. And it's designed to solve a number of problems that I think a lot of IT organizations have. One is just the too many admins problem. How many people don't have the too many admins problem? Okay, I don't see any hands. And so our approach is to get to, and we reached this milestone a few months ago, is to get to zero persistent admins. So there is, on IT managed servers in our data centers, there are zero IT standing admins on those machines. So basically any of the groups, any of the accounts of people that normally admin, their accounts default to no permissions. Credential theft and misuse. If you're a regular user, you get to use, you have a primary domain account that you use or an Azure Active Directory account, and that's how you get mail and that's how you do your stuff. But if you're an admin, you have to have a separate account. It's a non-email enabled account and it's multi-factor auth only. You'll never know the password. You don't need to know the password. You can never use it for anything. And again, that account, non-email enabled, separate alt account. Doesn't have any permissions in the environment by default. It can only get through permissions through a just-in-time workflow. So you say, hey, I need to access this, file a ticket, get somebody to approve it, and you have audited access to critical resources. For malware and phishing, this is really through really comprehensive allow lists and really saying, look, this is the only stuff you can run on these devices. Very, very, very locked down devices. And this is where Device Guard in Windows 10 plays a pretty big role. But you still have the local administrator password, right? Every device has to have one local admin password. And so we use vaulting to make sure that those passwords are unique across all devices, frequently changed, and nobody needs to know them. They're just set up in the vaulting system. And then finally, And this is important. We talked about our priority of protecting the supply chain. All of these protections don't do a ton of good if there's issues with the device itself. So there's some fun and interesting things we do to make sure that the device and the OS running on the device is secure from the moment it starts. So kind of a view, kind of a layered view, really starts from this secure device. From an operating system perspective, we turn on the user mode code integrity part of device guard. So basically, only properly signed software that we've previously authorized gets to run on this device. Secure boot is on, IPsec is turned on, so it's only secured network connections. And then these devices are fully managed, so we know we have all the right policies turned on, all the right audit events turned on, and all the proper controls are set up, and then everything is denied by default. Whether they're ports, programs, everything on the device is denied by default until you turn it on. And then we take an image-based approach as opposed to a servicing-based approach to these devices. So they can be re-imaged at any moment. If someone's worried about something for any reason, they can simply click a button, the device is pretty quickly re-imaged, with the latest fully up-to-date version of the operating system and all the right security controls. As I spoke before, we make extensive use of just-in-time elevation to make sure that even in the event, let's talk about what we're getting to here. If you want to access an elevated resource at Microsoft, basically you have to steal somebody's smart card. You have to steal somebody's secure admin workstation. Then you have to somehow make a request for just-in-time elevation against a certain target resource, and you have to get it approved. That's very, very different from the classic environment of I just go own an admin account and I can move freely about the cabin, so to speak. And then finally, just that dealing with local accounts on machines is equally important because we find this time and time again in breaches where folks really thought heavily about the frequently used admin and domain-based accounts, but they forget about local accounts on devices. All right, so now I'm going to show you a video that has never been seen outside of Microsoft. So you're the first ones that get to see it. Took a little heat for trying to show this, but we're going to show it. When I was talking about Hello for Business, I talked about how critically important it is to drive education awareness. I got to tell you, working in IT at Microsoft is an interesting job, working in a company alongside all the software engineers that wrote the software. So you can imagine how fun it is to talk to them when they call for support. They're used to having things their way. We have a flat, we started out, the company has a long history of flat open network, everybody's admin on their own machine, and people hate friction. They hate stuff getting in their way. And I talked about how important it is to reduce admins, but now we have these new things like DevOps and service reliability engineering, which is kind of a tension in the other direction, where you want more developers to have to really get their feet wet and have access to production resources so they can play a part in automating every fix. Don't rely on people getting up in the middle of the night. Make sure every time you see something, you automate the fix for it so you never have to fix it again. Well, that's all well and good, but what happens when freewheeling, admin everywhere, life is good, just let me be productive developer meets up with a secure admin workstation? That initial meeting was not kind. It was not fun, and we encountered a lot of resistance. So get a little bruises along the way. We learned, hey, it's not the what, it's the why that really matters. So we took another shot at it, and we created a video that was shown en masse to the thousands of developers and admins that have to use this. So see what you think.
Microsoft, our customers, and every connected device is a target of phishing. Drive-by downloads, third-party apps with malware payloads, and exploits for vulnerable and outdated software. Attackers are smart, organized, and sophisticated. They target your credentials, your workstations, your data, and anything you can access. Customer data, company information, and source code. Worst of all, attackers can damage customer trust in Microsoft. We need to make the right security investments. Social engineering attacks hack people, bypassing hardened network perimeters. Even one click is enough to compromise your workstation with malware that unleashes an attack, putting production services and critical servers at risk. But what if your PC could only run whitelisted applications with signed code, had no user admin privileges, blocked incoming remote connections, could only access whitelisted websites, and was top-of-the-line hardware with fully Mac specifications and the most current versions of Windows and apps? Introducing Secure Admin Workstations, or SAWs. Powerful, custom-configured PCs designed for ops and engineering. Now you can work securely with Microsoft production and staging environments and safely run your day-to-day productivity apps like Outlook and Office in a sandboxed environment on the same PC. The SAW pilot program is underway. Later this year, ops and engineers will get SAW devices. Learn more at aka.ms/SAW. Already have a SAW? Use it and give us feedback. Take the Strike training at the Strike website. We are Microsoft's best line of defense.
Okay, so how many people want a SAW after seeing that video? Aha. So, do they have smart card readers? Yes, they do. It was a very interesting experience. You know, I mean, I guess in hindsight, should have anticipated this because, you know, we got a lot of those same experiences with Hello. This is just one of those, you know, real IT lessons learned that I want to emphasize over and over and over again. Making a video like this is really cheap compared to, you know, some of the costs of, you know, trying to get things like this rolled out. Focusing on getting folks on board, helping them understand the why. You know, you can talk to a developer till you're blue in the face, and if they, you know, don't get the why, they're just not going to listen. They're going to resist. They're going to look for creative ways around this. But finding a pithy way to really get through and say, hey, this is the why. This is why this is important, and this is why you need to care, really kind of changed the mindset folks had to working on these devices. So I want to put it kind of together end to end and, you know, step you through the life cycle of how one of these devices gets created. So we start with this enrollment and entitlement process. And this one is super important because one of the things, remember, our objective is to reduce the number of admins. And remember, people don't like friction. So one of the interesting things that we saw was we would send people an email and say, hey, guess what? You're an admin, and we're switching to secure admin workstations, which means you're going to get a SAW. And your department's going to pay for it. And to get one, you just need to click here. You just need to click here. Super important point. And we send them another mail and say, hey, we haven't heard from you yet. Reminder, you have admin resources to these particular servers or these services, so you need a SAW. So, hey, just click here. And by the way, we've CC'd your manager for visibility. And then we send them one last mail. It says, hey, we know you're an admin on these resources. Because of that, you need a SAW. And click here to get your SAW. If you don't click here, you don't need those resources anymore, so we're going to remove all your entitlements. And if people didn't respond to that third mail in 3 weeks that included their manager, we just removed all their admin privileges. Some people call that scream testing. But believe it or not, the number of people that actually screamed after getting their admin entitlements removed was pretty low. You know, if you just go ask somebody, hey, is it okay if we take you out of this admin group? Come on, you all know what happens. Most people say, oh, no, I need that because, you know, once in, you know, 200 years, I might actually need to access this. But when it comes to, hey, my manager's on this, and I got to buy this workstation, and I got to do these things, it's like, well, I don't think I need it that bad. So interestingly enough, we were able to reduce the surface area just by making the user be part of the process that says, hey, it's time for me to get a SAW. So then SAWs come pre-provisioned. Basically, you know, I don't know how many folks are familiar with endorsement keys and TPMs and all that fun stuff. But basically, Microsoft is a company, and with Trusted Computing Group, we worked with Intel. When you buy an Intel PC with a TPM, that device has an endorsement key in it. And it's a key that we use. It's kind of a master of keys that we can use to securely send things to that TPM that are secure in transport. So Basically, this device gets, you know, provisioned with all this stuff. And when we get the device, computers, we have a list of all these endorsement keys. And what we're able to do is we take that endorsement key, and then we have this image factory where it's always the latest, most fully patched version of the operating system. We apply a silo-specific security policy to it. And what does that mean? Well, we have different groups at Microsoft that do different things. So the Office 365 folks may have some different app allow list needs or some different security policy needs or port requirement needs than maybe someone who's working in core Azure Fabric or somebody who's working in the Microsoft Store or something like that. So we'll configure that device for that OS for that specific silo, and then we'll do an integrity test on the operating system. And then here's the cool part. We have the endorsement key for the device that we know it's going to go to, so we're able to, in this image factory, in a VM, spin up this OS, get it ready, and then BitLocker it to a key that is in that target device. So when we're preparing this image in this secure image factory, it's already BitLocker protected before the image ever gets transported down to the device. So it sits up here in this environment, and it's ready for the device to be re-imaged at any time. So then when the user receives the device boots up, it contacts this high-risk environment or HRE environment. It contacts the image factory and says, hey, do you have an image for me? And it sends down that pre-BitLockered image down to the device. It cannot be tampered with in transport. It cannot be tampered with when it lands on the device because it's already BitLockered to a key that's sitting in that TPM. And finally, the user will log into the device for the first time, stick in a smart card, sign in. That device, the only form of connectivity that device has is it connects directly into the high-risk environment backend, which you could think of it as a kind of a mini data center where all the essential services sit in that HRE background. It's a separate admin forest, separate device forest. It's not in any of our core namespaces. Completely separate, has all of its own management hardware, VPN hardware, proxy hardware. Everything is contained in this small little area. And then when they're using that device, everything goes outbound through proxy. So we have very discrete control of, okay, I have this device. It's, you know, it's been provisioned securely. It's got this secure image on it. The only way it gets any external connectivity is talking through a VPN into this HRE backend. And then from there, it can connect directly into admin internal resources, or specifically only sites that have been specifically allowed. So it's an exceptionally tight configuration. So what did we learn in this process? The education and awareness one is really important, but it's also important to remember there is no silver bullet. There's been, you'll hear a lot about, you'll hear more about our secure admin workstations. You'll hear about our services arm has something called privileged access workstations. But the reason I walked you through that end-to-end process, because it's that end-to-end process, defense in depth, that really gives us that level of security. It's a big cultural shift. It's a big change to the way people work. So, you know, you have to get people ready for it. If you don't really spend time helping people understand why you're doing what you're doing, you're going to encounter resistance. And just like that experience I told you way back in 2000 when we were rolling out smart cards, people will try to find ways around it. A secure device has to enable productivity. People don't want to carry two devices around. So in the video, we talked about giving them a full email environment. Basically, the host OS is super, super locked down and is only used for those admin tasks. It'll, you know, only runs a few things, specific admin tools and things that you need for your job. But we do pre-configure a guest OS on it that's just, the guest is set up to just be a classic, normal info worker environment. They have admin in that environment. They get to do all that stuff that they normally do. But remember, it's in a guest, so it doesn't, you know, it can't touch the host. And all that connectivity still goes through the host switch, has to go through that VPN, gets fully inspected and managed as it passes through the HRE, before it goes out to the internet. So it's an interesting model where we're able to give people one device that they can use, and you know, if they get called at 2 a.m. and they need to go quickly fix something, they can do it straight from that device. but they also have that VM environment where they can get their email, they can browse to websites, they can run developer tools and other things that they need to do. So, I mean, it's a lot of stuff. So, oh, you had a question, sorry?
I'm just curious, does that VM environment bypass the VPN tunnel? Does it go direct out?
So the question is, does the VPN environment, does the guest OS bypass the VPN tunnel? No, it doesn't. So it has to specifically go through the VPN. It still goes through the same inspection. So we can still see what's going on, but it's not subject to the same outbound controls once it leaves the HRE. But if that device can't VPN, you know, if it can't contact the HRE, then even the guest OS has no network connectivity. So it's still, you know, we give them the environment where they can be productive, but it's not an environment where they are free of security auditing and oversight. So coming back to the kill chain, every time we see significant events in our network, we produce this thing called a threat summary report, which just allows us to visualize, and it's a great way to talk to executives, where we visualize the same way every time what happened during this attack at each step along the kill chain. So typical attacks, they all start out, you know, the delivery method, they come in via phishing, and you know, then we move to the exploitation stage where they try to dump some kind of malware on the device that you know, tries to help them move towards the command and control perspective where they're gonna you know, try and move around the environment, get access to more resources, and get them talking to command and control servers so that they can finally perform actions on the objective, grab data, grab PII, grab interesting information, steal your Twitter account, make you look bad, and all that stuff. So kind of how we put this all together is, you know, we talked about, you know, the using the, passport for work. Sorry, I missed that, Chris. Hello for Business. Chris, this is Chris. He keeps changing the name of these features. But Hello for Business. Look, this is an awesome feature. It's a crowd pleaser for users because it makes their user experience so personal. I just look at the device, I'm signed in. I just touch the fingerprint sensor, I'm signed in. You know, and even if I don't have a biometric capable device, 6-digit numeric PIN, and I'm in. But the important thing is, you're gonna remember this again and again and again. Even if one of those things gets disclosed, an attacker still has to steal the user's physical device to make use of that identity. So it takes all the scale out of the attack. And then, you know, when we talk about exploitation, device guard, user mode code integrity, app locker, those technologies, especially when it comes to those secure admin workstations, allow us to really tightly lock down what people are able to run. Because remember, you know, I see this as an industry thing. You know, we've come from a world where people tend to focus on known bad. They tend to focus on signature-based detection. You know, we're now moving to a machine learning-based world where people really try to build models of what's known good. So, and that's the safest thing you can do from an IT perspective, is start from an allow list of what do I know is good, so that when I see something that isn't known good, now I know what to look at. So I'm able to see things much earlier in the detection. So, and that's where Windows Defender Advanced Threat Protection really comes in. Behavior-based, algorithmic stuff, machine learning models run over the back end, allows you to not just detect earlier, but to really pivot and understand broadly across the environment what's going on, what do you need to do, and having the ability to do detonation and figure out, hey, I haven't seen this before, what's it really up to? And then finally, you know, really thinking about administrators. Protecting administrators is one of the most important things in an environment. If, you know, if we're gonna achieve our objective of protecting customer data and, you know, really stopping that critical part in the attacker kill chain where they get to that actions on objective phase. So where do we go next? What are we thinking about next? One of the things personally I'm excited about is, you know, I don't know how many of you follow the FIDO Alliance, Fast Identity Online, but FIDO is interesting because this is an environment where if you look at like the board level members of FIDO, this is a consortium in the industry that's really focused on how do we take really usable, friendly, strong authentication and bring it to the world, right? Because if you just get to use it within your enterprise, okay, that's great for your enterprise, but real users are accessing stuff all over the place all the time. And as we see time and time again, I'll come in through Facebook. I'll act like a friend in Facebook. I'll come in through Twitter. I'll come in through click this, and that's how people get spearfished. That's how people get nailed. So getting more of the world onto strong authentication is super important. And it's important enough that, you know, If you look at board level members in FIDO besides Microsoft, you have Google, Intel, ARM, Samsung, Bank of America, Visa, MasterCard, American Express. There's a lot of people in the industry that are including folks that normally compete against each other pretty heavily, are working together to try and come up with a solution that scales broadly across your consumer and your business world. So, our kind of big aspiration and what we're really looking forward to as this standard matures is being able to take that whole Hello for Business construct and being able to use it with all of our third party. I mean, today, Azure Active Directory federates with more than 2,000 other SaaS providers, so I can use Hello for Business in my enterprise to authenticate to all those different SaaS providers. But I also want to make sure people are using it with Facebook. I want to use it with Twitter. I want to use it with any SaaS provider. I want to use it to share data with business partners. And that's one of the things we're really looking forward to. Windows Information Protection is something that we're just in pilot deployments of now. That's super helpful to us because, you know, having this notion of you can only do enterprise stuff on one device or I can only do personal stuff on one device, that's just not terribly realistic in most environments. So, you know, we're really looking forward to this ability to have personal and business data coexisting in one place and, you know, allowing us as an enterprise to retain strong control over just the enterprise data without having to worry about, you know, the big broad device wipe scenario of taking away personal data, taking away somebody's, you know, first pictures of their kid walking for the first time or the first day on the school bus at kindergarten, because that's just a tough scenario for IT. Which leads to the third thing that we're really kind of in the midst of focusing on right now, which is full deployment of conditional access. Conditional access is a big deal to us because our aspiration, I've told you we've gone multi-factor auth everywhere, but really our objective is to access any Microsoft asset, to access any piece of data requires three things. Multi-factor auth, I'm managed, I'm healthy. You need all three of those things to be able to access any data, and that's where conditional access comes in. That's also where, you know, the Windows Information Protection will be important because an environment where anything you use to access our stuff, including email, has to be managed, well, that's a little bit of a culture change. So being able to, you know, give employees a way of saying, hey, but we're only going to, you know, we can only take away business data, we're not going to take away personal data, that's a super important thing. So I'll leave you with this, something that my boss talks about all the time. There's a big transformation coming. And, you know, as part of doing that, it's super important to really honor the past. It's the security world changes so fast, it's very easy to kind of criticize what's happened in the past, but the things people have done in the past, they did for a reason. And it's an important thing to learn from. As you can see, you know, a lot of the things that I've showed, whether it's, you know, some of the learnings we had rolling out Hello for Business, learnings we had rolling out SAWS, it's super important to learn from the past. If any of you saw Satya talk, you know, he talks about a growth mindset, but I love it when he says a learn-it-all versus a know-it-all. You need to have an organization full of humble learn-it-alls because this is a world of assumed breach. You're absolutely going to get breached. You need to be honest about that, honest with your business partners, honest with your board, honest with your leaders because, you know, I don't know how many folks have flying experience. I love to fly. I'm a pilot, and there's this saying that says, there's old pilots, there's bold pilots, but there's no old, bold pilots. Overconfidence is not a good thing in security, so you just need to be honest about what you're doing, but definitely build for the future. People are moving to the cloud, and it's just, there's so many advantages from a security perspective, from a telemetry perspective, from a seeing, you know, you basically have the insight of thousands of enterprises instead of the insight of one. You know, it's time to be ready for that culture shift, to really be thinking about it, and preparing for where that's going. So thank you very much for your time, and any questions I can answer? Thanks. If you do have any questions, if you could just step up to the microphone so folks who watch this later can hear. And if you don't have any questions, then thank you all very much. And I just want to say thanks to the team back in Redmond who spent a lot of time helping me put this together. It's been a lot of fun.